Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart, and you are listening to the MCrit Podcast. Today, we have a special guest. But before we get to that point, I want to announce the winner of Michael Cadogan's incredible toxicology handbook, and that winner is Jenny Mendelson. I don't know where Jenny works. I will find out. Jenny, if you're getting this, you will have an email in your email box with a request for you to get in touch with me and send me your address so I could get that book out to you. So back to the show. Hello?
How are you, mate?
And that, folks, is the voice of Cliff Reed, pre-hospital physician and a blogger at the site resus.me. Cliff, thanks so much for coming on the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I'm a trained emergency physician and intensivist with a special interest in pre-hospital and retrieval medicine, which I trained in the UK, and I'm currently working in Australia. Work for the Ambulance Service of New South Wales, the Greater Sydney Area Helicopter Emergency Medical Service, where I'm the Director of Medical Training.
Now, Cliff, are you flying as well?
Yeah, I am. I work on the helicopter, and I also work on fixed-wing aircraft and road retrieval ambulances.
So let's talk some pre-hospital airway, Cliff. And just as a preface, because I don't want my audience coming and lynching me, we have a large number of paramedics and other pre-hospital folks listening, and we are very pro-EMS on this podcast. Now, I have no doubt that you are going to represent pro-EMS as well, but there is a question of what is the ideal pre-hospital airway management strategy, and I'd love to hear your opinion.
Yeah, well, it's a controversial topic, and it's understandable why there's controversy because of the stuff in the literature that is on both sides of the fence. Should patients be intubated pre-hospital or shouldn't they? And if they should, who should be doing it? I think we should consider patients in the ED with critical care needs, whether it's a medical or trauma problem, and think about, are there any patients who it's obvious they need to be intubated from the moment we see them? And of course, the answer is yes. If you imagine a child who's fallen from a first-story window onto concrete, has trismus, is hypoxemic, is clearly going to be hypercarbic, they've got an obstructed, unprotected airway, there's no question that that kid definitely needs to be intubated. If they were in the ED, we wouldn't give it a second thought. So surely we should apply the same principles of resuscitation pre-hospital. So to me, the question is not should they be intubated, it's how can we do it safely? That's the key thing. And I think that's where the literature gets people a little bit fired up, because some of the stuff on paramedic intubation shows evidence, it's fair to say, of suboptimal practice, poor intubation success rates, a high rate of esophageal intubation. The most often quoted study, of course, is that one from California that looked at basic airway maneuvers compared with intubation in a sort of quasi-randomized fashion in kids who had, I think, a mixture of medical and traumatic complaints. And there was no benefit from the intubation group. But when you look at the methodology of that paper, they trained over 3,000 paramedics to do an intervention that they very rarely had to do. Some went the couple of years of the study without having to deliver it even once, and they only had a few hours of training. So in that context, intubation is unlikely to be demonstrated to be of benefit. If you compare that stuff with some of the rapid sequence intubation stuff, both from North America, but also from the UK, Australia, and Europe, where you have a physician-paramedic model working together in the field, then you can apply RSI to the same, if not higher, monitoring and quality standards as you can in hospital. And it's quite clearly been shown to be safe and effective when you have those systems in place. So if that was my kid, if it was me, if it was my wife, you've got trismus, you've got hypercarbia, you've got hypoxemia, you're 45 minutes from hospital, you've got to intubate me. You've got to do a good, safe RSI with adequate pre-oxygenation, adequate capnography, maintain good sedation en route, and keep my CO2 within normal limits. That's the care that I would want for me. You can tell that I'm pro pre-hospital intubation.
Now, you did mention systems that have physicians in the field. What about those systems that don't, Cliff?
Yeah, so not too far from here in Australia. I mean, I work in New South Wales, the state immediately south of us in Victoria. The MICA paramedics there are trained in rapid sequence intubation, and good studies just been published in the last few weeks demonstrating a high rate of success with RSI and improved outcomes with their RSI program. So I am not one of these guys that says it has to be done by a doctor, but I am of the opinion that it should be done by people that are exposed to a high enough volume of cases where they're going to maintain their skills and that they're working within a rigorously governed and audited system to ensure adequate safety standards.
One of my friends out in New Mexico, Darren Brody, conceptualized the idea of rapid sequence airway. He leaves his paramedics with the ability to give sedatives and paralytics, but instead of placing endotracheal tubes, they use that to facilitate the placement of supraglottic airways like LMAs. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I've heard of that concept, and I've worked with people in the UK that employ that in their systems. I haven't done it myself, and I'd like to see some outcome data. It seems to me to be an acceptable halfway house if you don't have the skills and systems in place for RSI. So again, if we look at this patient with trismus and a hypoxemia, obstructed unprotected airway, you've got to do something about that airway. And trying to ram an oropharyngeal airway in a patient with trismus isn't going to happen. Yeah, you can use a nasopharyngeal airway suction, bag valve mask support with good manual airway opening techniques. But if you've got a long transport time to hospital, you're going to want something else in place. But I've got no personal experience of this rapid sequence airway, and I'd love to see some outcome data from it.
As would I. Recently, the paramedics from New York City, the fire department in New York, who are just an astoundingly skilled bunch of paramedics, were given quantitative waveform capnography. And they were already pretty amazing, but I've just witnessed our unrecognized esophageal intubation rate go to near zero for the New York City area. Do you feel all systems should have waveform capnography?
Yeah, I think it should be mandatory, and there are guidelines coming out in the UK that mandate that. Your waveform capnography is a minimum monitoring standard in hospital, and give me one good reason why we shouldn't be applying at least the same standards in an environment that's more challenging and more difficult.
Absolutely. Auscultating lung sounds or hoping that that patient with vomit in their airway and endotracheal tube is going to be confirmed with a color change capnometer is just not going to be a workable solution.
Absolutely. And I've seen a couple of cases where the colorimetric device has failed. It's given a false positive reading for tracheal intubation. One example was fishing a drowning victim out of the Thames River in London, and he was intubated by a paramedic on scene. And when I arrived, I connected our EasyCap device and it immediately went yellow, but the abdomen was clearly distending and the patient was hypoxic, and on direct laryngoscopy, it was clearly the esophagus. It had just been stained by the acidic Thames water, I think.
If any of you folks out there in your ED do not have waveform capnography, maybe it's time to actually get that in your department. These color change devices, they are not the way to go. They're not reliable in cardiac arrest. They're not reliable if the patient has any vomit in their airway. And they're always showing me kind of gray zone color changes in my really shocky patients. What you want, both for ET confirmation and for a host of other uses we've discussed on the podcast, is waveform quantitative CO2 monitoring. Let's talk about choppers, helicopters, as a means of transport. Now, it obviously is a part of your service, so you folks believe in it. A lot of doubters out there.
Yeah, a lot of doubters, and again, that's understandable. I mean, helicopters are big, they're noisy, they're sexy, they're fun. And so they generate a big emotive response. Yeah, we all know from Boyle's law that the higher you go altitude-wise, the thinner the atmosphere. But actually, the thicker the cloud of testosterone vapor you get too as you go up there in helicopters. So, yeah, these issues can be clouded by those emotional factors, and particularly the observed high rate of crashes in certainly in the US of EMS helicopters, which has been of concern. I'm aware of that. I think like any tool or intervention, if it's used for the right indications, it can be a good thing. If it's not, then there's potential difficulties and sometimes harm. When helicopters crash, they kill people. So we don't want to be using them unnecessarily. But I think now there are really a number of reasonably of reasonable studies that demonstrate improved trauma outcomes with patients who are transferred by helicopter services. It's unclear as to the exact reasons for that. There are clearly differences between some of those services. It might be because helicopters are used to deliver teams with greater degrees of experience in major trauma, or critical care teams, highly skilled paramedics with RSI skills, or the British, European, Australasian model of a physician paramedic team being delivered to the patient is probably one factor. And the ability to take a patient directly to a trauma center with a shorter transport time might be another factor. But we've got to be clear that the helicopters are being deployed to the appropriate patients that need those resources. We're lucky, I think, where I work, in that this is a state-funded ambulance service that provides the helicopter response. And so we're not competing with anybody for business. We've got the business. We don't need to necessarily drum up clients. We're going to get called when we're needed. And we've got strict protocols for deploying our helicopters. And in addition, for any mission, our pilots and our physicians can decline to go on aviation reasons or clinical reasons. So we're really not obliged to respond. And we're fully aware of the evidence from crash data, particularly from the US, that shows an increased crash rate in poor weather and at night and with primary responses. So those are things we definitely think of before jumping in the helicopter.
Why do you think the US is crashing with so much more frequency than the other parts of the world?
I think one reason is there's just so much more helicopter movement, multiple helicopter EMS systems in place, you know, far more flights than there are in some of the other countries. So in terms of crash rate, the increased number of crashes, I guess, may not necessarily reflect an increased rate of crashes per flight. It just might be a reflection of an increased number of helicopter movements. I don't know the answer to that. I'm told that there are differences in aviation standards in the US and Australia, and some of the aviation guys I work with here are particularly proud of the standards of both aircraft quality and pilot training we have here. But that's certainly not something I'm qualified to comment on, or I'm in a position to compare between continents.
Fair enough. Let's talk about docs in the field. A number of the articles on Recess Me have dealt with the question of whether sending doctors out into the pre-hospital environment is helping patients. What's your impression?
Yeah, we have to be careful to distinguish the science from the anecdote. And if we're arguing from a purely scientific standpoint, we're not on really strong ground. The good studies really haven't been done. But there are a number of studies, not all in the English language literature, a lot from Europe and some from other places, that demonstrate different aspects of improved outcomes from physicians in the field. Again, I don't think it necessarily has to be a physician. I think it's all about meaningful interventions. You know, the pathophysiology doesn't really give a hoot about where the patient is. It's going to proceed regardless of location, but not regardless of intervention. So if a patient needs their airway securing, if they need their CO2 controlling, if they need their hemorrhage controlling, if they need their pelvis splinting, surely it makes sense to do this earlier on in the disease process than waiting until they get to hospital. You know, there are physician paramedic models, Europe, UK, Australasia, that do some pretty advanced interventions, and there are case series that demonstrate good outcomes. Let me give you a good case, see how maybe your guys would manage it in New York pre-hospital. But if you think about a 19-year-old man who's been involved in a brawl in a bar, he's been stabbed, single wound, left parasternal area, he's agitated, he's tachycardic, he's hypertensive. Maybe not relevant in your setting, but let's say he's half an hour from hospital. What would the approach be? So-called scoop and run or stay and play? I think pretty much anyone who knows anything about medicine would say this guy needs to get to hospital quickly. And that would be our approach with our physician paramedic model. We would be cannulating en route, we'd be giving oxygen, and we would be getting out of there and getting the patient to a hospital that has a cardiothoracic surgeon. But let's say 10 minutes into the journey, still 20 minutes from hospital, this guy has a cardiac arrest. He's increasingly drowsy. He's now bradypneic. He's bradycardic. His pulse has disappeared. He's got PEA on a monitor. What are we going to do? And here the debate about should you just scoop and run or should you be doing meaningful interventions in the field becomes really quite clear from my point of view. So we would intubate this guy, confirm with waveform capnography, do bilateral open thoracostomies. If we get our hiss of air and a return of spontaneous circulation, we're done. That's fantastic. But if it's not a tension pneumothorax, our next step is to assume this guy has a hemopericardium, and we proceed to a pre-hospital clamshell thoracotomy. We'd do a vertical incision in the pericardium, we'd remove the clot, and we'd see what we've got, put a finger on the hole. If the heart's at standstill, we'd do internal massage. If it's beating, great, control the hole. If he's fibrillating, then we'll defibrillate him. But 20 minutes from hospital, that's what this guy needs. Yeah, that's the meaningful intervention he needs. And as I say, the pathophysiology doesn't really care about the location. The patient needs a meaningful intervention. And the HEM service in London has published case series on these cases, but since publishing has managed many more patients just like that. And these are the kind of patients that survive to hospital discharge with a full neurological recovery, of course, if you intervene this early.
Next segment, Cliff talks about the concept of scoop and run versus stay and play. In my previous conversations with Cliff before the podcast, I knew this was a seriously hot button item for him. And I assiduously, throughout the interview, avoided mentioning the words scoop and run or stay and play. But at about the 40-minute mark, Cliff could not restrain himself any longer and just started busting out with this rant, which I just had to leave in because I think it is truly an excellent discussion.
Scoop and run versus stay and play. Yeah, I get that all the time. Hey, Cliff, we're doing a trauma conference. Can you talk about scoop and run versus stay and play? And to me, this is getting old and tired, but people still want to talk about it. And it's hard to get my head around. It's like somebody saying to you, Scott, hey, what's the right answer? Vasoactive drugs or no vasoactive drugs? You know, you're going to say, what kind of a question is that? It depends on the patient. So let's just break it down. How do you scoop and run? You've got a critically ill patient. If you really are subscribed to the idea of scooping and running with that patient, it really does. It really is based on some major assumptions, all of which I think are flawed. So the first assumption is that you can scoop, is that you can get that patient, pick them up and move to hospital. What if that patient's under a bus, squashed in a car wreck? You can't pick them up. There are patients that require extrication over prolonged periods of time, and they may have deteriorating physiology. And without meaningful interventions in the field, they're going to die. So firstly, there are patients that you can't scoop and run. Another assumption is that the interventions the patient needs can only be provided in hospital or can best be provided in hospital. And this comes back, I think, to this outdated paradigm that trauma is a surgical disease. You know, what's the proportion of patients with major trauma that have to go to the operating room as soon as they arrive in hospital? It's small, and it's probably getting smaller, isn't it? I think one study from a level one center in the US showed something like a roughly 1%, I think, rate of need for immediate OR in blunt trauma patients in adults and less than 0.1% in kids. I may have got those figures wrong, but it was in that ballpark. So very few patients need an OR and need a surgeon right away. So if they've got major trauma, if they're critically ill, what is it they need? They need good emergency medicine, good intensive care. And I know, Scott, part of your whole reason for being is bringing upstairs care downstairs. And we like to take it one step further, I think, here and take the upstairs care out the door and deliver it to the patient at 300 kilometers per hour. So the earlier we can provide this critical care, the better. That's our whole point of being. another assumption is that the quicker you get to hospital, the better. But this really has been blown away by some good studies. There's really not great evidence that short scene times improve outcomes. And the best example, I think, comes from Annals of Emergency Medicine earlier in 2010, looked at a very large number, I think 3,500 patients who were sick with major trauma. You know, these were patients with a 22% mortality rate, hypotensive, abnormal respiratory rate, abnormal GCS, or requiring advanced airway interventions in the field. So real sick patients, and they could find no link between survival and any aspect of pre-hospital times, time of call, time on scene, time to get to hospital. The stuff from Europe that looks at patients who are managed in the field by emergency physicians compared with non-physician management, and the emergency physicians spent longer on scene, but their outcomes were better. There's stuff from the UK that shows that patients that did require urgent surgery, going for laparotomy at a trauma center, the ones who got to laparotomy quicker were the ones who had more time on scene. HEMS physicians were on scene managing those patients, but getting them stable enough for transport, getting them packaged, taking them to the right center, and actually getting them to their definitive intervention of surgery sooner than through the normal process of care. So there really isn't good evidence that getting the patient to hospital quicker is of great benefit. So we really can deconstruct this scoop and run argument. And the other thing is that if you're going to scoop and run, you're assuming that it's safe to wait until you get to hospital before you deliver some of these interventions that the patients need. And again, there's good evidence that the majority of patients who die from major injury do die in the first hour, and the earlier you can deliver meaningful interventions within that hour, the better. And I don't know about where it is in your neck of the woods, but certainly even in urban Sydney and in lots of the United Kingdom, yeah, average time from your call to EMS, so from time of injury to time of arrival in hospital, is between 50 and 60 minutes. So this so-called golden hour, if you believe in it or not, is a pre-hospital event, even in Western urban countries. So if you're going to make a difference to these patients in the first hour, you've got to be delivering life-saving interventions in the field.
Moving away from clinical issues for a second, why don't you tell me about your resus.me?
Yeah, resus.me got started as a means of recording some of the stuff that I was reading and then immediately forgetting. I run courses in different areas of emergency medicine, critical care over in the UK, and I have to maintain currency with the literature so that I'm teaching the right stuff on the courses. And I was finding that I was reading all these articles but didn't have a good way of documenting what I'd read. And so now I use the blog platform as a means of writing this stuff down. And it is so useful for me. So people will ask me about a case or a particular topic, and I'll say, yeah, I think I maybe read something about that. And I look at my own website, and I discover that I blogged it the week before. I've already forgotten. So it's an amazingly useful resource for me, and I'm just delighted to hear that other people are finding it useful too.
No, I could attest to its usefulness. I recommend it to anyone who is interested in resuscitation, pre-hospital care, emergency medicine, or critical care. And we will put the address in the show notes in case you folks can't hear it just from what we're saying. All right, wrap it up there. Our guest today was Cliff Reed, pre-hospital physician, emergency physician, intensivist, incredible blogger at the site resus.me. And just a really incredible guy. I actually have enough audio footage to make a second show worth of Cliff, so you will be hearing more from him in the coming weeks. As always, if you have comments or questions, there are a multiplicity of ways you can get in touch with me, either Twitter, Facebook, comments on the show page at mcrit.org. Shoot me an email. There's a contact link on the webpage. And I'd love to hear what you think. So until next time, this is Scott Weingart for the MCrit podcast. Bye-bye.